Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, we have three really riveting stories for you today. First, 6 years after Lewis and Clark began their journey to the Pacific Northwest, two leading figures on the East Coast collaborated with a vision of their own. With dreams of transforming the United States into a Pacific trading power and democracy, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson turned their sights to founding a West Coast colony akin to Jamestown. We'll learn more about the amazing true story of the Astor Expedition in just a moment with author and correspondent for Outside Magazine, Peter Stark. We'll end today's show with MJ Rose. She's an international best-selling author of 14 novels and two nonfiction books. Each of her novels revolves around a secret trapped in time, a secret that people would kill for. Her latest novel is a gothic thriller set alternately in the 16th century and modern-day France. And we'll find out more about the collector of dying breaths in the last segment of today's show. And we'll also talk with debut novelist Hazel Gaynor. And I love this story because she's joining us from Ireland to talk about her novel. And that, too, is inspired by true events surrounding the Adagool 14. But she self-published and... long story short, was picked up by William Morrow and is now launching her debut novel in the traditional sense. So I look forward to talking with her too. First, I'm very pleased to welcome Peter Stark to the show. He's an adventure and exploration writer. He's studied English and anthropology at Dartmouth College, took a master's in journalism from the University of Wisconsin, and headed off to the remote spots of the world, writing magazine articles and books. He's been a longtime correspondent for Outside Magazine, and his essays have also appeared in some of the finest magazines out there today, Smithsonian, The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, and many others. He is best known, or his best known book, I should say, is The Last Breath, Cautionary Tales from the Limits of Human Endurance, and that was translated into seven languages and became Amazon.com number one best sports outdoor book for 2001. And Peter Stark's new book is called Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, a story of wealth, ambition, and survival. Peter Stark, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Vicki.
Well, this is such a fascinating story. I guess the first question I have for you is that how did you become, first of all, interested in it?
Well, it is a fascinating story, and it's really a largely forgotten story, even though when Washington Irving wrote this story in 1836, commissioned by John Jacob Astor, it was a bestseller of 1836. But it's been largely forgotten since then, which is one of the things that fascinated me about it. And I really randomly stumbled across it. I was... my previous book was titled The Last Empty Places, and I was profiling four different really unpopulated areas of the country. And so I was out in your territory, not or just short of your territory,
right,
out
right
there. I was in Eastern Oregon, and anybody who's been to Eastern Oregon knows it's really unpopulated. And I was driving down a long, lonely highway one night or one evening, and it was getting dark, and I was wondering where if I'd have to spend the night sleeping in the car in the ditch. And I came to a little town with a motel, and I spent the night. And the next morning, I woke up, and I learned the name of the town was John Day, Oregon. And I started thinking, now, who is John Day? Mm. You know, why would you name a town after John Day? And I started doing some research, and it turned out John Day was one of these original... He was a member of this original Astor expedition, the overland part of the expedition, and he had been traumatized in various ways. He'd been starved, he'd been abandoned, he'd poisoned himself by eating the wrong kind of roots rather than the right kind that the Indians were eating. He'd been helped by the Indians, he'd been stripped naked and sent out into the wilderness by the Indians. He'd finally become so traumatized, he faced with having to go retrace his steps. He tried to kill himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, it was such a crazy story of John Day, and that was just the tip of the iceberg of this big story of the of this John Jacobs Astor story and that story and expeditions. And he was actually a minor character in all this, but I just got drawn into it.
It's amazing. It's amazing where those ideas for bigger stories start or bigger explorations start. So let's talk a little bit about John Astor, first of all, John Jacob Astor, because he was a penniless immigrant from Germany. He became a multimillionaire, had a vision for the West Coast, the wealth that he could develop out in Astoria. He teamed up with Jefferson, who had a vision for democracy. Talk to us a little bit about how those two came together.
Well, that, you know, as you say, that John Jacob Astor was a penniless or nearly penniless German immigrant who came from a town called Waldorf, Germany, and thus the name Waldorf Astoria Hotel, which
I didn't know that. Okay,
I know it's a surprise when you put the two together. And he arrived in the U.S. as a young man right after the Revolutionary War, had met a fur trader on the ship over to America who said you could make a lot of money in the fur trade. Astor was bringing with him some finely made musical instruments. He ended up setting up a shop in Manhattan, which was then a tiny little town, tiny little city at the tip of Manhattan Island, a shop that sold this bizarre combination of finely made European musical instruments and wild animal pelts from North America. And he eventually made a fortune in the fur trade, and he started looking west, and he worked with Canadian fur traders who were pushing out towards the Rocky Mountains. He realized, he saw early the potential of the Pacific Rim, of the whole West Coast. And previously, about 20 years previously, Captain James Cook expeditions had been through the West Coast and really charted the Pacific, the first European vessels to really chart that part of the Pacific. And Cook's men discovered that you could buy a sea otter for the equivalent of $1 on the Northwest Coast, what's now Vancouver Island, and sell that fur on the other side of the Pacific in China for the equivalent of $100.
Wow.
And so that started off this, you know, that incredible markup started off a kind of fur rush of various Yankee and British ships. Okay, you know, every one or two a year would land on the Northwest Coast and pick up sea otter furs and take them to China. Well, Astor had a much broader vision. He envisioned how he could essentially capture all the furs from Western North America, funnel them through a port at the mouth of the Columbia that he would found, the first American port, first American settlement on the West Coast, send those to China, sell them and buy Chinese silks, teas, porcelain, bring those back to London and New York, sell those at a huge markup. So he'd have a fleet of ships continuously circling the globe, making a huge profit at every stop. And he approached Thomas Jefferson in 1808 with this vision and actually wrote Jefferson a letter. And Jefferson invited him to the president's house in Washington. And Jefferson had just, you know, recently sent out Lewis and Clark. And Meriwether Lewis had come back from the West Coast after a long and difficult journey saying, well, there's no easy way to get there, but it would really be great if America had a seaport at the mouth of the Columbia. So together, Astor and Jefferson met at the president's house, and they fired themselves up on this vision of this sort of trans-global, trans-Pacific trade empire that would be based at the mouth of the Columbia. And Astor saw it as a commercial endeavor, whereas Jefferson was seeing it as planting the seeds of democracy on
right,
the West Coast.
Nobody really owned it. Anything out here then, right?
There was not in terms of white settlement. No, there was nothing. You had down in Mexico, you had the Spanish settlement. You know, the Spanish had been in what's now Mexico for 150 years, but they'd built settlements. But they were well south. They'd built missions just in the recent decades. They'd built a few missions up as far as San Francisco, there was a Spanish presence, you know, just barely along the coast as far as San Francisco. And then the Russians had just recently built some fur posts up in Alaska. So in what's now Sitka, Alaska, was the farthest south Russian post. So between San Francisco and Sitka, you know, that's probably 1,500, probably close to 2,000 miles of northwest coast, totally unclaimed. And it extended all the way to the crest of the Rocky Mountains. So that's another, you know, think of how far inland that is.
Yeah,
it's an area,
right,
you know, about the size of Europe, where there were no settlements whatsoever, white settlements. So it was this huge chunk of you know, kind of no man's land. And, of course, there were Native American tribes everywhere. It wasn't no man's land. It was no man land in terms of white, you know, European powers. So Jefferson saw this, had this idea of planting the seeds of a democracy on the West Coast, and that he actually saw it as a sister, kind of a sister democracy to the United States, which at that point was, you know, basically totally crowded on the other side of the Appalachian Mountains. It was all along the East Coast, you know, a little bit in the Ohio Valley, but not very far. And Jefferson saw this democracy on the West Coast spreading across the continent and joining the democracy that already existed on the East Coast, and together they'd join. So that was his vision. So there was a commercial vision and a political democratic vision going
right
on between the two men.
And they decided to send out two parties. They sent one overseas around the Cape Horn, which is always treacherous, the best
right
of times.
Yeah. And in this case, it was especially treacherous due to the personalities involved.
Yeah, a captain, or a ship's captain, apparently, who just ruled by force.
By iron fist, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And then the Overland Party, which I found probably more fascinating because I've done some of the Lewis and Clark Trail.
Oh, have you? Oh, good.
Were the ones who... they followed that trail until they got to a certain point, and they ran into some folks, and one of the guys had been scalped, and they decided to take a 1,000-mile detour because of that. Talk to us a little bit about that.
It's a fascinating story. And as I say, you know, I just channeled the story. They were existing out there, this unknown story that, you know, largely unknown as the historians know about it. So Astor came up with this plan. He was a meticulous businessman, you know, really far-seeing, very conscientious, very bottom-line oriented. And so he came up with this plan to send a two-pronged expedition to establish this, you know, this Jamestown of the West Coast, this first American colony, one by sea and one overland. The Overland Party was led by a young New Jersey businessman named Wilson Price Hunt, who was, I think, 27 years old, and very conscientious guy, you know, serious-minded, very loyal to Astor, liked to lead by consensus. But his big drawback was he'd never been in the wilderness before, and he was supposed to lead a party across the North American continent, you know, the wilds of the Western.
I don't want to interrupt you, really, but that so surprised me, because on both the overland and the sea voyage, they didn't really have any exploration experience between them.
Well, the leaders didn't, and that was a huge issue, and that's one of the things I write a lot about, is how there were these pivotal leadership decisions that would actually shape much of the North American continent in the hands of these leaders who were very different personalities and not necessarily qualified to make them.
Mm.
And I think the reason that Astor chose these, at least in the case of Wilson Price Hunt, the young New Jersey businessman, Astor knew that Hunt was an American and would be loyal to Astor for, you know, in whatever case, whereas a number of the other members of that overland party that Hunt led were expert Scottish fur traders and French Canadian voyageurs who were actually loyal to the British crown. And
that's
why Astor chose Hunt to lead it. So as you were saying, that Hunt was supposed to follow the Lewis and Clark route with this huge expedition, you know, twice the size of Lewis and Clark, 60 people, you know, maybe 10 or 15 tons of gear, up the Missouri. Following the Lewis and Clark route, which, as you know, goes up the Missouri, then over the Rocky Mountains, and then down the Columbia. And they got partway up the Missouri, and they started hearing more and more horror stories about the ferocity of the Blackfeet Indians at the headwaters of the Missouri, and one day met these three trappers coming down the river in canoes, one of whom had been scalped, and who said, "You really don't want to go up that way. You know, the Blackfeet are—they're really angry because Meriwether Lewis killed two of their young men and left the Jefferson Presidential Medal hanging around one of their necks, and they're just don't go up there. But actually, we think we can lead you on a way that detours south of the Blackfeet." And the hunt was in this dilemma whether to follow the known route into right into Blackfeet territory, the Lewis and Clark route, or to strike off, leave the Missouri, and to strike off into what was essentially 1,000 miles of more or more of completely uncharted terrain. And he made that decision after a lot of agonizing to go off into the uncharted terrain. And he found some really difficult going.
Yeah. In retrospect, I read in the epilogue that that was a good decision in retrospect because it found the best way through for future explorers. But they did not know that at the time.
They didn't know that. And it ended up, well, Hunt stumbled around and, you know, they almost all died because they trekked 4 months across what's now the Dakotas and Wyoming and into Idaho and crossed the Tetons, and the three trappers said, "Well, here's a little river. We think this leads to the Columbia and to the Pacific coast. You can just build canoes here and paddle down." Hunt, you know, due to his lack of experience, had been kind of dilly-dallying along and not really feeling the rush of time. He'd never been in winter in the mountains before. And I don't think he'd ever been in the mountains at all before. And so by the time they even built canoes on, you know, this is around where around Jackson Hole, Wyoming, just west of it, it was already late November, and they got in these canoes and started paddling down the river. You know, this huge party, 50 people, you know, 10 or 15 tons of gear, huge canoes, and the first day was great. You know, the river was fast, it was smooth, they made a lot of mileage, everybody's happy, the voyagers are singing. Second day, they hit a few riffles. Third day, they hit rapids, they swamp two canoes, lose a lot of the trade goods and food in one canoe. By the ninth day, they're going over major waterfalls. The canoes are smashing. The voyagers are drowning. They end up stuck in the Snake River Canyon in early November and running out of food. They have to go on foot now. They split up. To make a long story short, they end up stumbling into Hell's Canyon, which is the deepest canyon in all of North America. It's now on the Oregon-Idaho border. And it's winter, and they get caught in Hell's Canyon with no food, and people are starting to drop dead drop from exhaustion and starvation. And Hunt is now in this dilemma whether to stick with his dying friends beside the side of the trail or lead his expedition out of this canyon to try to find some Indian villages. And in this party is a woman who's like a Sacagawea character, but even more so, she has the wife of a Native American, wife of the interpreter, Marie Dorian, is her name, and she has two toddler boys, and she's also pregnant, and she's part of this party. And she holds up amazingly well through all this.
Yeah.
But through all that, all that stumbling around, Hunt's route, and the guys who came after him and went back the same way, they ended up discovering what became the Oregon Trail, the easiest route across that part of the Rocky Mountains where you could actually take a wagon through. So they found the way, basically, but yeah, they certainly suffered for it.
They did. They faced an incredible danger, violence, hunger. You say almost half of them died. Others went totally mad.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about the madness that happened.
Well, for instance, John Day was one of the characters who was clearly suffering from PTSD. And he was, as I was saying earlier, he was the first character I came across in the story. He was part of that Hunt expedition, and he was one of the guys who was in Hell's Canyon in the winter, and he'd gone ahead with another group on an exploratory mission and come back to the main party. And by the time that he got back, he was so exhausted, they'd run out of food. You know, he was just dropping. Hunt ended up leaving him behind, and another guy named a Scottish fur trader named Ramsey Crooks. Ramsey Crooks and John Day ended up having to fend for themselves all winter long, trying to get out of this total wilderness. You know, they were starving, then they poisoned themselves by eating the wrong roots, and then they lost the tracks that they were following through the snow, and then they finally reached what they thought was safety on the Columbia River, and they were met by some Indians. They'd been helped by previous Indians, but these Indians stripped them naked and told them to go back to, you know, go away and
don't
come back.
Right.
By that time, John Day he was about done with it. He was beyond done with it. He was finally rescued, and they made it to Astoria. The settlement had started by that time. The sea-going party had made it to the mouth of the Columbia and started the settlement. And John Day, these stragglers, made it there. And 6 weeks later, they had to turn around and go back the same way to deliver messages to John Jacob Astor overland.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. And and John Day started, you know, they got a few days. Well, you all know this geography. They paddled from the mouth of the Columbia, what's now Astoria, up as far as, right around the Portland area. And they got to an island right around Portland, what's now Portland. And, you know, from there you can see Mount Hood very mm-hmm, clearly. Mm-hmm. And there's, just reading the medical literature of PTSD, there's a well-known phenomenon called a triggering device or a trigger, that it can be a sight or a sound that triggers memories of a traumatic experience. Well, John Day got just about to that point where he could see Mount Hood, which is near where he'd been stripped by the Indians and sent back into the wilderness again. And he started just talking crazily, and, you know, he just sort of went mad, you know, other explorers write in their journals.
Understandably.
And they were camped that night on, I think it was called, Strawberry Island, or I think Strawberry Island, near what's now Portland. And in the middle of the night, or just before dawn, he pulled out two pistols and he put them to his head and he pulled the triggers.
Mm.
And he missed. I mean, I don't know how, but he did. And they had to kind of tie him in a canoe and put him offshore so he couldn't get into any more trouble. And they finally sent him back to the mouth of the Columbia.
Yeah.
But there was another guy who had been abandoned a year or two earlier, who these explorers found out in the wilderness wandering around, and he'd gone totally mad.
Yeah. Well, you can understand. I mean, it's bad enough traveling today, but traveling back then was a whole different thing. Peter, we're right at the end of our segment. We're going to have you back, because I didn't even get to a fraction of the questions I have for you.
Well, it's such a big story, and it's such an unknown
it is.
Story. And it's actually a very historically significant story, which we didn't touch on that part. We're not even to the mouth of the Columbia yet.
No, I know. This is all in my notes. You're just going to have to come back, okay?
I'm happy to come back anytime.
All right. Well, we would love that, because I love this book. It's beautifully written, as we would expect by somebody who does the kind of work you do. The book is Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, a story of wealth, ambition, and survival. And my guest, of course, Peter Stark. Thanks, Peter, for being with us.
Thank you so much, Vicky. It's really been fun.
And please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services, if you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Next week on Conversations Live, imagine getting a new job because someone read your blog, not your resume. Imagine your hobby becoming your career due to a big following of support. Imagine growing your business or focusing on your art while developing a community of like-minded people. Austin Kleon tells us how he created his own unique and creative lifestyle and shares how it could be possible for you too. In Show Your Work, 10 ways to share your creativity and get discovered. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Going against the grain has never been so much fun. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. I feel like I've got to speak really quickly because we've got loads to get into today. But I'm very pleased to have Hazel Gaynor with me. She is a fellow Brit. She's actually in Ireland right now, but she's a very exciting new voice in historical fiction. Her writing's been featured in the Sunday Times magazine and the Irish Times. She was the recipient of the 2012 Cecil Day Lewis Award for Emerging Writers. She's originally from North Yorkshire, and as I said, she's now living in Ireland. I heard during the break she went that way because of a handsome young man, and they now have two young children. Welcome to the show, Hazel Gaynor.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me on, Vicki.
And I want to let listeners know your new book is called The Girl Who Came Home, a novel of the Titanic. And this is slightly different because it's based on true events surrounding the Ada Ghoul 14, members of a church parish in County Mayo, Ireland, which I'd not heard of. Why did you choose to write the story this way? I know you said that the Titanic fascinates you. Why did you pick out this particular group to write about?
I think, well, the main draw was because I now live in Ireland. And obviously, you know, as I say, I had a fascination with Titanic for many, many years. I'd rather not say how many. and when I decided to write about Titanic, first of all, I was terrified because it's such a huge subject matter. And I think so many of us have at least a passing fascination with Titanic, and there are so many experts. So it was quite a daunting topic as a debut novel as well to start to tackle. But I was very clear from the beginnings of the very first seeds of an idea that I wanted to look at the Irish connection. Obviously, Titanic was built in Belfast. They are very proud of the shipbuilding heritage. And I also knew that Titanic's last port of call was in a small town of Queenstown, which is now called Cove in County Cork. And I don't know if many people are aware of that part of the Irish connection. And obviously, most of the passengers who boarded at Queenstown, being Irish, were travelling third class. They were steerage passengers, were very poor. And I felt that that very human, very raw side of the Titanic story possibly hadn't been as well told. And I felt that those people were all boarding this amazing ship for very, very different reasons to the likes of the Guggenheims and the Astors and the Strausses, who were returning from European vacations. And I was mm-hmm. just fascinated with those difficult conditions in which those Irish passengers in particular were boarding Titanic. And I felt that those were the most extraordinary stories to tell about this huge event. And that's where I started researching.
So Great Nana Maggie is one of the characters. 21-year-old Grace Butler is introduced in this too. Are these real characters, or are these characters you put into the book to support the story?
Yeah, all of the characters in my book, well, the majority, there are obviously, there's some passing reference to actual crew members on Titanic, obviously Captain Smith, you know, the very well-known Bruce Ismay. There is very passing reference to them for authenticity. But the characters that I have written about, so Maggie is my heroine, really. She boards Titanic as a 17-year-old girl who is emigrating to America with her aunt, and she's leaving behind the man that she loves and very distraught to be leaving home and leaving Ireland. And she travels with her aunt and 12 other members of the community, very small community. So I certainly took the basis of the Adagool 14 as the premise for the novel, but I was very conscious that I wanted to give myself that little bit of freedom as a novelist to weave more into these character stories. I think I would have felt very, very inhibited if I had used the real names of the real people, and that would have been more a factual, non-fiction account of the event. So I suppose Maggie is an amalgamation of maybe three of the younger girls who travelled from the real group of the 14. And her aunt would have been the woman who was maybe the one who had organised for the group to leave their parish together. So I've sort of taken shades and aspects of the real facts and built my characters around them. And then Maggie's great-granddaughter, Grace Butler, because the novel is told in time slip. So we move from 1912 to 1982, and we see Maggie as an elderly lady, and she has this very touching relationship with her great-granddaughter, Grace. And Grace is a young girl who's struggling for very different reasons, but I hope that there are parallels between the stories of the young Maggie and Grace, and
yes.
they're both trying to find peace with events that have happened in their life.
Yes.
So Grace and everything that happens in 1982 is very much purely fiction, but certainly shades of the real Adagool 14 in the characters on Titanic, yeah.
Yeah, and this is a debut novel, but you've already hit major success, because I want to share with listeners that you couldn't find a publisher for this book originally. So you decided
no.
to produce an e-book on Kindle. Then that led you to producing a paperback book. And tell us what happened then.
Yeah, so, yes, I think I went through what every writer probably has to go through, a rite of passage of that rejection, and very difficult to, you know, keep going. But I really believed in this story, and I felt so passionately about Titanic and my characters. And I think the Yorkshire grit in me just refused to back down. And I suppose when I wrote the novel, it was in 2011, and actually, I shouldn't probably admit, because I'm a Titanic fan, but I hadn't realised 2012 was the centenary. So I knew that I had an opportunity to sort of bring out a novel that would tie in with the centenary of Titanic. So I took the plunge, and I self-published the novel as a Kindle ebook, and it was very well received and did great. And a year later,
well, I think you got the
contact
Amazon number one, right?
Yes, it hit the number one on the historical fiction bestsellers list for Kindle. So I was absolutely blown away. You know, here I was in my attic locked away when the children were at school, and I had this bestseller on my hands. So it was all a little bit strange, but brilliant. And so I kept writing. I wrote a second novel, and the year after I'd published, I was contacted by an agent, Michelle Brower, who's based in New York, and she had read the book and loved it, and approached me to represent me. And I then had the second novel completed, so the two were submitted to William Morrow, and I got that call that every writer dreams of.
Mm.
And 5 years after starting out, tentatively writing a blog of my own, I was delighted to be offered the publishing deal for both The Girl Who Came Home and the second novel. So The Girl Who Came Home has now been re-released as a paperback and as fiction in America and within the UK and Ireland as well. So I couldn't be happier.
There you go. And I read about all that on your blog. It's at hazelgaynor.com if listeners want to go there. There's some interesting stories on your blog, Hazel. And tomorrow is the anniversary, April 15th, the anniversary of the Titanic sinking. So what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I think I'd just like to leave listeners with perhaps a slightly different side of the Titanic story. As I say, most of the feedback I've had from readers so far is that they've really come away from reading the novel amazed by the steerage, the third-class experience of Titanic, and they've really felt that they were glad, even if they thought they'd read all of they could about Titanic and they thought they knew everything about Titanic, it's sort of immersed them in a slightly different aspect of the event and, some of the facts that you just can't get away from, the terror of that and the gentler side of a really human side to this story as well. And I think, we can't forget the human tragedy of this event. And I hope that I can leave people with a new insight into a slightly different aspect of an event that we do all know a lot about.
Yeah, well, I loved hearing your success story and your novel is going on to great things and we want to have you back when your second one comes out, okay?
Oh, I'd be absolutely delighted. That would be wonderful.
And I want to tell listeners where they can find you. Hazelgaynor.com. Hazelgaynor.com is your website. And I read this, I couldn't believe this on there, that in the Telegraph, I think last week, earlier this year, the Chinese announced plans to build a full-size Titanic replica, which will form part of a theme park so visitors can experience a simulation of the sinking. You said not for me, not for me, and I'll agree with you on that one. I'll pass.
Hazel, step too far.
Hazel Gaynor, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much.
You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Sailing in a strange boat, heading for a strange shore. We're sailing in a strange boat, heading for a strange shore.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
This is Meryl Streep. Over the years, I have played some characters you could call controlling, but the truth is, there's so much in life we can't control. But here's something we can: colorectal cancer. It affects men and women, and it's the second leading cancer killer in the U.S., which is astounding, considering it's almost entirely preventable. Here's how. Most colon cancers start as polyps, and screening helps find polyps so they can be removed before they even turn into cancer. Screening also finds this cancer early, when treatment works best. For me, screening was simple and quick. It was no big deal, except for the huge sense of relief you feel afterwards. There are several tests that you can choose from. If you're 50 or older, you should talk to your doctor. Decide which one's right for you. Take control. Do everything you can to prevent colon cancer. Screening saves lives. It could really save your life. For more information, call 1-800-CDC-INFO.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL. Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Dr. Bill Burlingame and Immune Tabs, we cover the world of animals. This week, April 20th, it's Easter with Kevin McDonald and Kim Miller, medium and animal intuitive. It's also their farewell show. Due to busy schedules, they're stepping away from the microphones, so it's your last chance to let Kim help you connect with your animal or human loved ones on this side or the other, and to thank them and wish them well. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
The search is over. You found the station that's not afraid to be different. Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m.
Ever hauled aboard. We're sailing on a strange sea, blown by a strange wind. We're sailing on a strange
And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And let me tell you the name of Hazel Gaynor's book. I covered it with something and I couldn't see what I was about to tell you the final thing and my brain just blanked out. It is called The Girl Who Came Home, a novel of the Titanic, The Girl Who Came Home by Hazel Gaynor. All right. I'm very pleased now to welcome my last guest today, MJ Rose. And she has interesting stories to share with us, too. She's the international best-selling fiction author of 14 books and also two nonfiction books. She's the founding board member of International Thriller Writers and founded the first marketing company for authors, AuthorBuzz.com. And she lives in Connecticut with Doug Schofield, the composer, and their very spoiled dog, Winker. Welcome to the show, MJ Rose.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. I want to say your new book is called The Collector of Dying Breaths, which in itself is a fascinating title and kind of sparks the imagination there. Many of your books have real characters in, and this is no exception, but it is fiction. So tell us a little bit about why you do that, why you approach books that way.
Well, it's just whatever winds up appealing to me, whatever stories I find that spark my interest. So for the last, I guess, within the last six books, there have been facts and real people who've done things that have melded well with the fictional story that I want to tell. And I think that since I'm writing a little bit about reincarnation in these books, they're fiction, but there's a little bit about reincarnation in them. I think that, and I'm not advocating reincarnation. My characters rarely believe, the main character rarely believes in it. It's just that I use it as a metaphor. But I think that because I am writing about something that's kind of esoteric and a little odd, that it helps when I include people in the books who are real and have their thoughts and feelings about some of these subjects. I think it gives the books feet.
Right.
In a way that helps readers navigate through them.
Right. Well, in the past, some of your some of the people you've included in books, you've included Cleopatra in the Book of Lost Fragrances, Seduction, another book had Victor Hugo in there. And now in this book, The Collector of Dying Breaths, tell us your character in this one.
Yeah, there was also Beethoven was in The Memorist, so it's something I've been doing for a while. This book has Catherine de' Medici and her perfumer, a man named René LaFlorentine, who was her perfumer. In the mid-1500s, Catherine de' Medici, who was a young Italian duchess, and her perfumer, who was a slightly older, he was only 17, she was 14, she left Italy to go to France to marry Prince Henry, the king of France's second oldest son, and she took, as they were wont to do, over 300 people with her. You didn't travel back and forth easily back then. So when you moved to another country, you took half of your friends and family with you. So she took, among other people, her perfumer with her. And they got to France, and they really revolutionized France in terms of fragrance. There was no fragrance industry in France when they arrived, so to speak. And after, during her reign and then in her daughter's reign, the fragrance industry really got started. So the book is really about her perfumer, and she's a character in the book for sure. But he's the main character in the book, and it's a story about his search for an elixir that would help him take someone's dying breath and figure out how to reanimate it. The belief is that your soul leaves your body in your dying breath. And if it's possible to reanimate that dying breath into somebody else who's alive, you could keep somebody's soul alive. That's the theory.
Right.
So Renee is trying to do that in the 1500s. And in the present day, my other main character, Jacques L'Etoile, is also on the hunt for that same formula.
Right, right. And that, I believe, I mean, I can't remember the culture now, but I remember reading an indigenous culture that really believe in that, in trying to capture that breath. And so it's not, you know, there are people actually out there who've believed in it in the past.
Yeah, there are a lot of people, especially the one that I think amuses people the most is Henry Ford, the creator of the Model T, and Thomas Alva Edison, the creator of the light bulb, among millions of other inventions. Both believed in it so greatly that Thomas Alva Edison had his dying breath captured.
Really?
And the test tube of it is in Henry Ford's museum. Yeah, there's a picture on the internet you can see. But Thomas Alva Edison's dying breath was captured. Nobody has yet brought it back.
That is so fascinating. It sounds feasible almost, but, you know, I'm not saying it is. So let's talk a little bit about how you got interested in fragrance. And that's kind of an interesting story. Then you used to work in the ad world, the Mad Men world, and did a campaign for a fragrance there. And you've been fascinated with it ever since, you say.
Yes, I was lucky enough when I was in advertising to get to work on a perfume brand from its inception, where we got to actually be involved in naming it, all the way through the formula, the bottle, and then creating the ads for it, and then seeing the ads run on the Oscars in addition to other places. And I really did fall in love with the world of fragrance then.
Yeah, I read that it's been called the eighth art. I never heard that before. Tell me about that.
Yes, that's what perfumers call it, because creating a perfume really is an amazing art. I mean, sometimes when you, I think we all, perfume's everywhere, and we've always, you know, grown up with perfume, and our mothers wore perfume. I think we take for granted a little bit just how amazing it is when you think about how perfumes are created and mm-hmm. how they were created originally, and some of the strange things that are in perfumes. Like, one of the main ingredients of perfumes until recently, and now it's synthetic, but it was not always synthetic, is something called ambergris. And ambergris is a secretion that a whale vomits that then gets kind of cured by the sea,
right.
Winds up washing on shore, and tens of hundreds of years later, is used by perfumers in perfume. It kind of gives a perfume a creamy scent and blends all the different notes together. And you kind of go, okay, so whatever made the first person who found this lump of gray stuff on a beach, who didn't even know what it was, lump of gray stuff on a beach, look at this lump of gray stuff, which by itself is pretty much no scent, and said, I'm going to take a sliver of this and I'm going to put it in a perfume. But there's another ingredient, which I talk about in my book, which is, this is true. There's an ingredient called momi, M-O-M-I-E, which in the Middle Ages and earlier, they used in perfume. It was the secretion of an embalmed corpse that came out of the brain.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
And you had to unwrap a mummy
right.
and then scrape this black, shiny, sticky stuff off uh-huh. of the bones of the skull and use this in a perfume. Now, it's one thing to even unwrap the corpse. It's another thing to see the sticky stuff. Then it's a third thing to actually say, I'm going to take this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do something with it. And the doing something with it is putting it in a perfume?
That's
like crazy. So I find it's just perfume is such a strange and beautiful. But it is an art, because it has to be an artist who takes you know, mummified remains and tries to make something beautiful out of them.
Yeah, well, years ago I toured, I spent some time in the south of France, and I went to Grasse, and which is the capital of, you know, where they make the perfumes,
yes,
the perfume houses.
Yeah.
And I toured the houses down there, which is really quite fascinating. And they made us our own individual little perfume while we were there, which was really cool. So, and but you talk about how fragrances bring back memories, and the one thing that, and this is an odd smell, but whenever I smell ant spray, I think of Paris, because I was in a boarding school in Paris for the holidays, and we had an invasion of ants in the dormitories, and so the caretaker came in and sprayed ant spray everywhere, and to this day, when I smell ant spray, I think of Paris.
Yes, you know, there's a whole interesting thing about this, that the way that your scent memory works, what happens is when you breathe in, neurons are affected by the scent. Every scent has its own signature. Every tiny little, like a lilac, has its own set of neurons. I mean, oil, anything has its own, even a pure single thing, like a lemon. So when you smell it in, your nose has these neurons in it that take it right to your brain, to the olfactory center. And the olfactory center of your brain is literally touching your memory center.
Mm.
And so that's why scent is the most closely associated with memory of all the senses, because they are so connected in the brain.
Yeah.
So it is a kind of wonderful thing, isn't it, how close they are, and you can smell something and remember something forever.
Yes, yes. It must be dreadful to lose your sense of smell. The family that is in the book, build the perfumes, tell us a little bit about them, because they're based on a real family, loosely based on a real family.
No, they're actually not based on a real family.
They're not based on the Ghislaine family?
No. I mean, I think I was inspired by the idea that there was a French family of perfumers that went back a long time. But the family in my book, the L'Etoile family, goes back much further than the Ghislaines. In my book, my main character belongs to a family of French perfumers that go back to before the French Revolution. And they still enter existence. There are actually quite a number of French perfume houses that are very old. So I love Ghislaine fragrance. So I just, you know, people have asked me, and I've said, well, I was certainly inspired by them, but it's not actually based on them.
Right, right. So what do you hope listeners will take away from this book?
Oh, just that they enjoy it. I don't really try to. I have ideas of the reason I write and the themes that I write about, but I don't really talk about them, because what I really hope is that somebody just reads the book and loves reading it. There's a fabulous love story, actually two love stories in the book. There's suspense. There's a lot of, there's a little bit of magic. I just hope that people enjoy it.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about the international thriller writers, because I wasn't really familiar with those until I was reading your material here. And you're the founding board member, or a founding board member, right?
Yes.
Current co-president with Lee Child. Tell us a little bit about the work you do with international thriller writers.
So a group of us started this in 2004. Lee Child was one, Gail Linz, David Morrell, and we created this organization called International Thriller Writers to do two things. One was thriller writers always kind of are the stepchildren of the mystery genre, and we felt that it was time for our own organization. Thrillers are actually the number one selling genre of all books, but they'd never had their own organization before. So the fun thing for readers is we have an event in New York every year called Thriller Fest, and dozens of thriller, best-selling thriller authors, amazing thriller authors, come and meet and greet fans and sign books and do panels. And this year, it's I think it starts July 11th, and it's in New York, and Anne Rice, Lee Child, Jim Rollins, Steve Barry, Joe Finder, Lisa Gardner, David Baldacci. I mean, it's amazing who's there.
Yeah.
That's really fun for people who love the genre. And the thing about thrillers is they really go across the board. There's romantic suspense, there's spy thrillers, there's legal thrillers, there's domestic drama thrillers, there's, in my case, historical fiction, or also a little paranormal. So it really covers just so many wonderful books.
Right, right. Well, I appreciate you being with us today, MJ, and I want to tell listeners where they can find you. Could you give us your website, please?
Yes. really complicated, mjrose.com.
I figured. I just didn't write it down. I figured. MJ Rose, I want to say thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate it. The book is called The Collector of Dying Breaths. It's quite an interesting read. And I love the fact that you've woven a real character into the fiction there. Thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And I want to thank you for being with us today. We will be back next week live with an all-new show. And if you have questions on today's show or comments or didn't catch any of the information and want to get in touch with any of our authors today, you can reach me through info@conversationslive.net or at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. We're also on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.